Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, including nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week my guest is David Lockbaum, Director of the Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists, which monitors licensed commercial nuclear power plants in the United States to identify and publicise safety risks. David Lockbaum has more than 17 years of experience in commercial nuclear power plant startup, testing, operations, licensing, software development, training and design engineering. In 1992, he and a colleague identified a safety problem in a plant where they were working but were ignored when they raised the issue with the plant manager, the utility and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. They decided to go to Congress, and the problem was eventually corrected at the original plant and at plants across the country. David Lockbaum received a Bachelor of Science in Nuclear Engineering from the University of Tennessee in 1979. He's been a member of the American Nuclear Society for 30 years and has written numerous articles on various aspects of nuclear safety and published two books entitled Nuclear Waste Disposal Crisis and Fission Stories. David, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Helen. Nice to talk to you again.
David, it would be good if we started by talking about what the safety problem was that you and your colleague identified in 1992 when you were working for the industry. What was the problem and at which plant?
The problem was at the Susquehanna nuclear power plant in northeastern Pennsylvania. The plant's owner was considering increasing the maximum power output of the plant by 5% so they could make more money, generate more electricity. And they had a team of consultants in to look at ensuring that they could do that without compromising safety margins. The colleague and I were looking at one of the safety systems. In this case, it was the spent fuel pool cooling system. And we found that in case of an accident, there were plenty of safety systems that were there to cool buildings and cool equipment to make sure that the reactor core and all of the equipment needed to ensure the reactor core continued to be cooled would be available and would function as necessary. But there was no means at all to remove the heat generated by the irradiated fuel in the spent fuel pool.
Uh-huh.
And that wasn't just a moot point, because there was about five times as much heat in the spent fuel pool as from all other sources combined, and it was being ignored. So we raised it to the plant owner. They did nothing. Their initial reaction was, how could we have missed it for 10 years? You guys must be wrong. It's been looked at 10 times, 20 times before, so obviously you're wrong and everybody else was right.
Uh-huh.
So we went to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and that's what really galled me, was my colleague and I sent all of the paperwork the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, our side of the story and the plant owner's side of the story. And the whole document was about 3 inches thick, duplexed. But I made a mistake. I took it to a local copy company to make copies, and they only single-sided copied it. So the copy that the NRC got was missing every other page.
Oh, dear.
And they never noticed it.
Oh.
They never noticed it. So obviously, they never even read past page one of a safety concern. So that's when the colleague and I went to the United States Congress, and fortunately, we got some very good help from some members of Congress to get that trickle-down effect. They put pressure on the NRC, who then put pressure on the owners to fix it. And you shouldn't have to go to that much effort to fix a safety problem.
Okay, so a few questions arise from that extraordinary situation. The uranium is enriched to 3% to operate a nuclear power plant, but how did they increase the power output?
What they do, originally the enrichment of the fuel was on the order of less than 3%. Now they're increasing the enrichment of uranium-235 in the fuel to close to 4%. So basically the number of fuel assemblies stayed the same, but they're operating with more uranium-235, which allows two things. One is higher power levels, and the second is that the plants are running for longer periods of time before shutting down for refueling. Originally, it was every 12 months. Now, some plants are running 2 years between refueling outages.
Why?
Money. The bottom line to everything is money. If you're originally, these plants are running at about 60% capacity factor, which means they were making electricity only 60% of the time. Now, with the two-year outages and other factors, they're running at 90, 91% capacity factors. They're cranking out money almost every day.
So, David, what are the risks of increasing the power and the uranium 235 to 4% enrichment, one, and two, only shutting the plant down every 2 years to inspect it? What are the risks associated with those two problems, increased power and running them for longer?
Well, the increased power concern is that you basically have less margin if something goes wrong.
What does that mean?
If, for example, if you're driving a car at 55 miles an hour and you increase the speed to 75 miles an hour, if something moves out in front of your way, mm-hmm. you know, a child or another car, you have less time to take evasive action or to stop mm-hmm. when you're traveling at a far faster mm-hmm. speed. In a nuclear power plant, when you're operating at higher enrichments, higher power levels, if something goes wrong, a pipe breaks, a fire starts, a terrorist tries to sabotage your plant, you have less time, less means to take corrective action to prevent the bad day, or if the bad day occurs, it becomes much worse. And that's the second part of the equation. By running longer periods of time, you're building up more radioactive byproducts in the fuel that's in the reactor and in the spent fuel pool, for that matter. So if something does go wrong, either an accident or an act of terror, the radioactive cloud is much, much larger because you have a larger inventory of these nasty materials to be released and cause harm to people downwind.
And also, you're only doing your inspections every 2 years instead of every year, so pipes may become embrittled, they might break, there may be problems that are not picked up. Is that correct?
That's correct, and what really troubles us about that is the failure rate of people, of cars, of light bulbs, of nuclear power plants is dictated by something called the bathtub curve. For people, the left-hand portion of the curve is the infant mortality stage, where the chance of an illness leading to death is higher than it is when you reach peak middle health. The right-hand portion of the curve is where people start getting old and the chances of dying once again increase.
Like me, my pipes are getting rusty.
It's just a fact of life. For nuclear power plants, they justified doing less safety tests and inspections by saying, look at the left-hand portion of the curve. The times that we're seeing broken pipes and worn-out motors is decreasing, so therefore we don't have to inspect as much. But the reality is that there's that other part of the curve, and if you're not looking for problems, they'll find you instead of you finding them first.
Well, now, you know, we've been talking about the mechanical and engineering problems, not in great depth, but to give people some idea of the risks. What I want you now to do, David, is tell us how much radiation is in an average size 1,000-megawatt nuclear reactor that's been running, say, for 20 years or, you know, on an average time in the United States, the 104 reactors. And if there was an accident, A, what could the accident be? And B, what would happen if there really was a major accident, i.e. a meltdown? Can you just walk us through that? How much radiation in the reactor and what would happen if there was a major accident and how would that occur?
Well, there's actually two major hazards at each operating nuclear power plant. That's the reactor core, which contains on average about 100 tons of irradiated fuel. And then there's the spent fuel pool, which can, depending on the age of the reactor, can hold 10 or 11 times as much irradiated fuel as the reactor core does. If either one of them experiences a problem, the fuel can either overheat and melt down or catch on fire. Either case, they release the radioactive contents, which is immense. It's a tremendous amount of, initially for the reactor side, there's radioactive iodine, iodine-131, that's a tremendous health problem. There's longer-lived radioisotopes like cesium and strontium, ruthenium, that if they get out, they have half-lives measured in decades.
How much radiation is in a reactor core? Can you give us, not just in terms of sort of measurement of becquerels, but to give an example of what it actually means, the amount of radiation in a reactor?
Well,
the
bomb that the United States dropped on Hiroshima had approximately 35 pounds of radioactive material. The energy released killed a lot of people, and the radiation that was released by that 35 pounds also killed and harmed a lot of people. The average reactor core of one of our reactors has 100 tons of radioactive material, many orders of magnitude more than the material we used in the Hiroshima bomb. That doesn't mean that a nuclear power plant can explode and create a mushroom cloud, but it doesn't have to. If there is a release, like there was at Chernobyl in 1986, that radioactive material that escapes can cause damage to a lot of people for a long period of time. There's still huge regions of the countryside around the Chernobyl reactor that you're not allowed to go into because it's heavily radioactively contaminated and will be like that for decades to come.
Yes, and I suppose I should step in here because I'm a pediatrician, a children's doctor, to say that over 8,000 people have developed thyroid cancer. It's actually probably much more now in regions surrounding Chernobyl, and they've had their thyroids totally removed by surgery. You can't live without your thyroid. Like a diabetic who has to have insulin every day, they have to have thyroid replacement hormone every day or they'll die, A. And B, of course, once you've had thyroid cancer, it tends to spread and metastasize throughout the body, and those people have had their thyroids removed now are at risk of dying of cancer, that there are homes now full of grossly deformed, mentally retarded children in areas that were heavily irradiated near Chernobyl, such that my colleagues, the pediatricians, have never seen this before in their years of the practice of medicine. There are now huge numbers of children and young adults developing leukemia from the accident. The incidence of cancer they've found in France is increasing. In Sweden, it is increasing. There are over 300 farms in Wales and Cumbria growing lambs that are so full of cesium-137 they can't sell them on the market. And according to a very good study, up to 40% of the European landmass is still radioactive. And as you point out, David, will be so for decades, but actually hundreds of years. And as radiation bioconcentrates in the food chain, now, it's not a very good idea, actually, to buy European food. And I know the French won't like that. They need to sell their wine and, you know, the like and the like. But we need to be cautious, and cancer is not a very nice disease to get. And very often it's incurable.
I agree with that, and even worse than, even if you're lucky enough to avoid the catastrophic accident that was Chernobyl and your plant doesn't have the meltdown and is never attacked by terrorists, the fuel cycle itself, the mining of uranium from the ground and the disposal of the irradiated uranium at the other end, it's a huge health consequence, and we have not managed that risk very well in this country or in the worldwide, and untold numbers of people have died from exposure to radon in the mines as they mined for the uranium, and from the byproducts of reprocessing of fuel, as some countries do, and from the disposal of this nasty stuff, if we ever figure out where to put it.
Yes, well, you know, in your country, I'm taping this from Australia, but we've got 40% of the world's richest uranium here in Australia, and politicians eager to dig it up, and corporations, of course. But in your country, there's been no remediation. They just dig the uranium out of the ground. They get the uranium, concentrated uranium, out of the ore, and they leave millions of tons of what they call tailings, but the byproducts of removing uranium from the ore, lying around often on Navajo land. And so these tailings piles emit radon gas, and people living nearby are inhaling radon, which is a potent cause of lung cancer. They're also eating fish and the like with radium in it, which leaks from the uranium tailings into the water supply and concentrates in fish. In your country, in the past, 30 to 50% of men who've mined uranium have died of lung cancer. And that's only the beginning of the fuel cycle. And, of course, uranium becomes, I read the figure, David, 1 billion times more radioactive when you actually fission it in a reactor. So the amount of radiation you're inducing by fissioning uranium is intense, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I used to work in nuclear power plants, one of my jobs was to inspect the new fuel as it came from the factories. And I had to wear gloves, not to protect me from the radiation, but to protect the metal rods from the oils on my skin from corrosion. Mm-hmm. Yet once it's in the reactor, just the opposite. I can't even get anywhere close to it, whether I'm wearing gloves or not, because doing so would be a suicide mission.
Well, describe. I've always quoted the fact that if you stand next to just one spent fuel rod, which is half an inch thick and 12 feet long for a couple of seconds when it comes out of the reactor, you'd get such a dose of gamma radiation, like X-rays, that you would die within 2 weeks. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've one of the studies that's been studied, or one of the accidents that's been studied, is that if you accidentally drain the water out of the spent fuel pool, what happens? And those studies show that somebody standing at the railing looking into the pool would receive a lethal dose within 9 to 13 seconds, depending on how recently refueled. One of the, I guess, gallows humor that we used to do when we were removing fuel during refueling was if you accidentally caused one of the radiated fuel assemblies to breach the water, if you pulled it out too far, would you die before you hit the ground? Very close. It's one of those arguments, either way, whether you do or you don't, you're gone. I mean,
well, so water actually stops the gamma radiation from escaping, like lead, huh?
Yeah, water, particularly, it depends on how much. We had at least 8 feet of water to protect us from a single fuel assembly, about 22 feet of water to protect us from a lot of fuel assemblies. If you don't have water, you need something else that's very dense to protect workers and the public from that radioactive emitters. The denser, the better, whether it's lead, you need several feet of concrete to do the same thing. Steel or bunches of water.
Well, now, we've talked about 100 tons of highly radiated fuel in the reactor core, and if it loses its coolant, i.e. the circulating water, that could melt down, like happened at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. But I think one-third of the reactors in America, and there are 104 operating reactors, have their spent fuel pools on the roof of the reactor. Is that accurate, David?
It's not on the roof. It's up in the upper floor, where the roof of that area is the ceiling of the reactor building. Yeah, roughly one-third of the reactors in this country, and many reactors around the world. It's just not the United States that has this problem. Put the spent fuel pools way, way above ground. The reason that was done was in those days, in the 1960s, it was thought that the fuel would be there for just a short period of time, then it would be shipped off-site for reprocessing or disposal.
Yeah.
When President Carter decided that reprocessing was a bad idea because people could divert to plutonium for bombs, we just stopped doing anything, and the spent fuel pools are now filling up, and nobody gave it a second thought, the fact that this stuff is very high up in the ground. It's a very high-risk safety problem, and it's also a very attractive target for terrorists.
Okay, so describe what a terrorist could do to a spent fuel pool, David.
Well, the outside wall of the spent fuel pool in these plants is the outside wall of the building. So if you were to hit that with a missile or an aircraft or a shaped platter charge, you would likely cause that concrete to fail. It's only 5 or 6 feet thick.
You mean they'd make a hole in the concrete?
Right. Just poke a hole in it, which would allow the water to drain out.
And then what?
The worst situation is if you partially drain the water out. You drain it out and leave maybe 3 or 4 feet at the bottom, because that prevents air coming in, like a chimney effect, coming in to the bottom. So essentially you're getting no water cooling, you're getting no air cooling. The fuel in the reactor can heat up and start to catch on fire in a matter of hours.
You mean the fuel in the spent fuel pool?
Yeah, the fuel that's now been uncovered by the water that drained out. In some of our plants, that can be 10 or 11 times as much fuel that's in the reactor core.
So let's go on that scenario. So it starts burning,
right,
and it's up to 11 times more radiation in the spent fuel pool than in the reactor core itself. What happens then?
The Brookhaven National Lab here in the United States examined that question in 1997, and they said that the consequences could go out 500 miles. The fatalities could be about the same as in the worst-case reactor accident.
Which is?
The only difference being, in a worst-case reactor accident, you kill a lot of people in the first year. In the worst-case spent fuel pool accident, you kill the same number of people, but a higher percentage of them are from latent cancers and other consequences that kills you in 5 or 6 years. It's kind of why we dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima instead of a spent fuel pool. But you still get a lot of deaths, a lot of destruction, a lot larger.
How many deaths did Brookhaven estimate?
40,000 to 50,000.
And what's that study called?
I forget the exact name of it. But came out in like August of 1997.
Yeah. So let's just explain that to the audience. If there's a meltdown in a nuclear power plant, the radiation is so intense that if you're engulfed in a cloud of these very short-lived, highly radioactive elements, you'll get such a dose of gamma radiation that the actively dividing cells of your body die. So your hair falls out in a few days. The gut sort of desquamates, so you get terrible nausea, vomiting, and bloody diarrhea. And your blood cells, you know, the white and red blood cells, stop forming in the bone marrow. They die, and you die because you can't fight infection of massive hemorrhage or infection the way AIDS patients die. And that's called acute radiation illness. And people would die, tens of thousands of them, within 2 weeks. Whereas if you're exposed to radiation from a spent fuel pool, which is less actively radioactive and giving out less gamma radiation, but these materials get inside your body and irradiate body cells, you would develop cancer 5 to 60 years later. And that's why the nuclear industry get away with what they do, because it takes a long time to get your cancer after you've been irradiated. And they call that the latent period of carcinogenesis. And that's kind of their secret, that they, and when a cancer does occur, look, it doesn't wear a little flag saying, I was made by some radiation you got from a nuclear power plant 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, the footprint for the radiation or for the cancer is difficult to track back to either radiation source or smoking or many of the other things that can lead to cancer. But it is known, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the more you're exposed to radiation, the more likely you are to develop one of those health consequences that can either kill or, as you described earlier, the thyroid problem that may not kill you but totally messes up your life.
I'm interviewing David Lochbaum, a nuclear engineer from the Union of Concerned Scientists. You've got huge experience testifying before Congress. You really know what's going on in the reactor industry in America. I want you to talk about the plants that you know are at risk at the moment, as most of them are aging rapidly, getting to the end of the bathtub curve. And talk about the Davis-Bessie problem and Browns Ferry briefly. Then I want to talk about the NRC.
The Davis-Bessie reactor is just north of Toledo, Ohio, in the middle part of the United States. In 1991, a similar reactor, Bouguer in France, discovered that one of the metal tubes that connect a motor for the control rod drive to the control rod that's inside the reactor core, control rod is like a brake for the nuclear engine. When you withdraw the control rod, it allows the uranium atoms to fission or split more frequently, increases the power level. When you insert the control rod, you do just the opposite. You stop or interrupt the chain reaction, and you cause the power level to go down. The motor for the control rod's outside, the control rod's inside, so you have a long rod that penetrates the reactor vessel through a metal tube to connect them. The French reactor, Bouguer, discovered that metal tube was cracking. So the French very promptly jumped on that and fixed that problem at Bouguer and all other reactors like that in France. The French told the rest of the world about that problem because it wasn't confined to the French reactors. And in Japan and Italy and other countries that had similar plants also undertook repairs. In the United States, we got that warning from France. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission went out to one reactor. We operate over 100 in the United States. They went out to one reactor, did not see the problem at that reactor, and said, well, it can't happen here, and never looked again. Until, flipping forward 10 years, in 2001, workers at the Oconee plant in South Carolina found, just like the workers at Bouguer had found, that metal tube was cracked. They went in, looked at it, and the NRC professed to be surprised, even though a decade earlier they'd been warned about it. But with their surprise, they said, okay, all other reactors like Oconee must shut down by the end of this year, by the end of 2001, and inspect those tubes to make sure they're not as bad or worse. Davis-Bessie was on that list. There was a list of 12. Davis-Bessie's owners were going through a merger. They didn't want to shut down. They didn't have a scheduled refueling outage coming up. They showed up with their lawyers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and said, we're prepared to take you to court. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission caved, as they do again and again, and allowed the plant to continue running into 2002. The only plant in the United States that was allowed to do that. Every other plant that shut down by the end of 2001 found cracking and leaking. Davis-Bessie didn't. When they did shut down in 2002, they found, lo and behold, that they did have a metal tube that was cracked, and the acidic water, the water that's used in those kind of reactors is slightly acidic, was eating through the metal vessel that contains the reactor core. In fact, it had eaten completely through that metal.
And how thick is that vessel?
It's about 6.5 inches thick. It was completely gone down to a thin stainless steel veneer that's put on the inside to protect the metal from the acidic water. since the water leaked on the outside, it ate its way down back to that stainless steel cladding. And that stainless steel cladding, which is less than a quarter inch thick, was bulging outwards and cracked due to the high pressure. The Oak Ridge National Lab in this country looked at that condition once it was found and estimated that had that plant, had Davis Besse operated for 60 more days, somewhere between 60 days and 11 months, 2 months to 11 months, that hole would have opened up to the point where it would have burst. And we would have had an accident worse than Three Mile Island, perhaps not as bad as Chernobyl, but you don't ever want to be anywhere where those are your two bookends. What troubles us most about that was a very bad near miss. The NRC itself says that's the closest we came to disaster since Three Mile Island. But the NRC in September of 2001 had prepared an order that would have required Davis Besse to shut down. Shutdown orders aren't something the NRC does every drop of a hat. The last time they prepared such an order was in 1987. So this is very extraordinary for the NRC to do, but the NRC managers told the NRC staffers to just put it aside, don't worry about it. We don't want to cost this company any money and allow them to continue going. What troubles us about that is you'll never build a stronger circumstantial case that millions of Americans are in harm's way, and the NRC managers who did that, made that bad decision, suffered no consequence. In fact, one of them got a $40,000 bonus the next year. And the problem, the bad decision-making, the bad management, the total disregard for American lives has not been fixed yet within the NRC.
Okay, so as you describe this, and I know there are many other cases, Browns Ferry and others, it seems to me that those fellows should have gone to jail. I'm just looking from a public health perspective and the risk to the public, and they did nothing. I mean, what else should have happened to them? I feel so strongly about this.
I agree with you. Some of the workers at Davis Besse were indicted by the U.S. government and are facing jail terms.
Were indicted, the poor things.
Right.
But not now. Describe, what is the NRC? How many commissioners are on it at the moment? What is their background? Who pays them?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a part of the executive branch in this country. They're part of they work for President Bush.
For the White House.
For the White House. There are five presidentially appointed commissioners who each serve five-year terms on a rotating basis. So every June 30th, one commissioner seat is becoming vacant, and so that you don't replace them all at the same time. The rest of the staff, and right now there's about 3,500 people working for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they're government employees. They work regardless of who's in the White House, regardless of the commissioners coming in or leaving.
Work in the DOE, Department of Energy?
No, they used to. In 1974, an act of Congress separated what is now Department of Energy from what is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The reason that act of Congress occurred was there was a concern that the Atomic Energy Commission, which was the predecessor of those two agencies, was too cozy with the nuclear industry. So the thought was, we'll split the regulators out, which is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, from the promoters of nuclear energy, which is the Department of Energy. But other than a logo difference, there's not much difference between the two.
Well, how is the nuclear industry itself and all the corporations involved with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? What's their incestuous relationship?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is not funded by the American taxpayer.
Really? Why not?
An act of Congress about 18 years ago established that once the budget for the NRC is set up, whatever it is, then the NRC divides by the number of nuclear power plant owners it has, the number of nuclear pharmacy licensees it has, the number of there are many other licensees of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It divides by the number of those and just sends an invoice to each plant owner for its services. Right now, the average nuclear plant owner, I think, pays about $4 million a year to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for its budget.
So these fellows regulate the nuclear power industry, but they are employees of the nuclear power industry. Therefore, how can they adequately and officially and scrupulously regulate the industry?
Well, they technically work for the United States government, other than the fact that their money comes from plant owners. So it's regardless of who pays their check, they need to be getting the job done. And in some respects, I think the Nuclear Regulatory Commission should be doing a better job. In many respects, I think they should be doing a better job. But the United States Congress is the one that oversees the NRC, and the United States Congress shouldn't wait until Americans die before they hold hearings into why the NRC is such a bad regulator.
What committee is in charge of the NRC, David, in the Congress?
In the United States Senate, there's the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee.
Who chairs
that? It's Senator Boxer's in charge of the committee. The subcommittee that's specifically tasked with nuclear energy is Senator Thomas Carper from Delaware, and the ranking member, Senator George Voinovich. I must give credit to Senator Voinovich. He's from Ohio. Davis Bessie occurred in his backyard. He got all over the Nuclear Regulatory Commission when the NRC said we weren't going to do anything to fix safety culture, which was a major factor in the Davis Bessie near miss. Senator Voinovich said, you will do something about this or we will. And that threat led the NRC to making some changes that has the agency better overseeing safety culture. But that's only one of many problems that the NRC has, and we need to do a better job of working off that to-do list.
What's the House subcommittee?
On the House side, there's two committees. One is the House Commerce Committee, and I forget who chairs And the House Government Investigations, which is Representative Kucinich, Congressman Kucinich, who's done some great work.
Oh, he'd be on it.
Both Davis Bessie and some other problems we've had.
Well, now, so apart from all of this sort of bureaucracy that we're talking about, you're on the ground all the time, David. What do you see? And most of the plants in America are really aging. Their power is being pushed up. They want to extend their lifespan for another 20 years. What's the risk of pushing up the power, B, extending the lifespan for another 20 years, and C, just as an overall generic estimate, what do you think the risk of a major meltdown is in the United States now?
On the path we're headed, I think it's more of a matter of when and where that catastrophic accident will occur than if we're going to have one.
Hmm.
We're so complacent. You know, Davis Bessie should have been a very serious wake-up call. I mean, like you pointed out earlier, some of the NRC people should have at least been fired. Perhaps some of them should be working in one of our penal institutions, but none of that happened. We're so complacent, and the reason we're so complacent is because no one died. So, it must have been okay. No one died. This tombstone regulation where we assume things are okay until people die is the philosophy the United States used for Hurricane Katrina. It was what we did before the space shuttle Columbia landed in both Louisiana and Texas. It was the same philosophy we used when the space shuttle Columbia or Challenger took off and exploded 73 seconds after takeoff. We know there are problems out there. We don't lift a finger to fix them until people die. And that, you know, I think if you look at nuclear power in the United States, the 104 plants we have operating today are all heading towards that wear-out portion of the bathtub curve I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
if they're not already in it. And we're talking about building new nuclear power plants in the United States, which drops them down in on the break-in phase. Those are the two high-risk portions of the curve. The best defense the Americans have against that high risk is an effective regulator, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is more like the Keystone Cops than it is an effective regulator. So it just seems it's a matter of time more than...
What's the risk of extending these plants, you know, that are some of them 40 years old now, or 30, another 20 years, extending their lifespan, David? What's the risk?
Well, I think the concern is that we're doing it all at the same time. We're increasing their power levels. We're increasing their lifetimes. We're cutting back on the number of safety checks that are done at the plants. We're doing all of these things at the same time. I've compared it in speeches testimony before the Congress and in presentations to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to a straight-A student who all at the same time decides to stop going to class, stop studying for tests, stop doing the homework because, well, after all, I'm a straight-A student. I didn't need to do it. If you do all of those things at the same time, chances are pretty high in the next semester you're not going to be a straight-A student anymore. You ought to do those incrementally to make sure that you're still maintaining a certain performance level. Here in the nuclear industry, we're doing them all at the same time. They're not going to manifest themselves as problems tomorrow, but they might next year. And the way they manifest themselves is in huge headlines across the world that could make people forget about Chernobyl.
You know, as you talk, the gravestone philosophy, I mean, if we practice medicine like that, we'll wait till people die. It's the antithesis of any morality that we have in medicine. You know, we work to prevent people dying, not wait till they're dying.
It would be one thing if there were no evidence suggesting trouble. You know, if there yeah. wasn't the Davis-Bessie near miss, if there wasn't, you know, people say that we, and rightly so, that we haven't had a reactor meltdown in the United States since 1979. But since that date, we've had 46 of our reactors have had to shut down for at least a year to restore safety levels to the right level. Mm. You know, they got far below the minimum level the NRC sets up, and they've been that way for years. So there's 46 times we got much closer to having a reactor meltdown than we should have. And those are 46 wake-up calls that we slept right through.
Well, talking of sleeping, I just want to tell the people listening that I'm interviewing David Lochbaum, a nuclear engineer from the Union of Concerned Scientists. And David, speaking of sleeping, do these problems, I mean, you're so intimately involved with them, keep you awake at night?
No, I just wish I slept as well at night as the NRC apparently does during the day. well, I don't know if you... Speaking of that, and it's really shouldn't be funny, but it is in a morbid sense. About this time last year, the former security manager at the Peach Bottom plant, the Peach Bottom nuclear plants in Pennsylvania, sent a letter to the resident NRC inspector at that plant saying the security guards at this plant are sleeping routinely. And he told them where and he told them when, and the NRC didn't believe it. And all they did was they sent a letter back to the plant's owner saying, could this be true? The plant's owner asked a few people, and they said no, so nothing more was done about it. Well, luckily, the security manager and some of the security guards at the plant were more conscientious than the NRC will ever be. They went to WCBS and gave a TV reporter a copy of a videotape showing the security guards sleeping, all of them. And that was shown on TV, and all of a sudden, the NRC got religion. That day, they called up the plant. They had people, NRC inspectors, looking over, and they confirmed security guards were sleeping at the plant. The security contractor was fired. A number of things are being done differently. But it shouldn't take positive visual evidence for the NRC to get its act in gear.
Well, I know that security guards sleep at other plants, too. They work too long. Their hours are too long. And sure. They're not paid enough and the like and the like. And they have test terrorist attacks. They warn the plant 6 months before this is to happen, and over 50% of the time the terrorists actually get into the plant itself, right?
We're concerned about that aspect as well, the people from the outside attacking the plant who've been successful far more often than they should be, even with advance notice and a bunch of other things that hinder their operation. But I'm also concerned, after having worked in plants for 17 years, one of the things we used to do at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're in the control room, it's kind of boring. We used to play a game of who could sabotage the plant in the fewest number of steps.
Oh, my God.
He wasn't...
David.
He was just meant to kill time more than anything else.
Oh, yeah, right.
it's amazing how few steps one can... So somebody on the inside who wants to cause trouble...
Or who became psychotic.
It would be ridiculously easy. For years, even before 9/11, we've been arguing that plants should have cameras that monitor inside the plant. If you look at the security cameras at nuclear power plants, they're almost all faced outwards to look at the bad guys coming close to the fence, which is important. You need to have that. But what about the people inside the plant who might be causing problems? There are more security cameras in 7-Elevens and casinos than there are in nuclear power plants.
Oh, my God. And, you know, I know as a physician, I've seen patients who are absolutely clinically sane because of stress or family problems become psychotic overnight, you know, and people can have breakdowns, depressive episodes and the like. So we're dealing with an technology with which we have to be infallible, operated by absolutely fallible human beings. David, you are so knowledgeable on this subject. How many people in the United States do you say, or would you say, are as knowledgeable as you are and with your finger not on the button but on the knowledge button that you have? How many similar people do you think there are?
I actually think there's probably tens of thousands of people. There's, I think the difference, having worked in the industry and now working for a safety advocacy group, I still have some colleagues who still work in the industry. The industry has a neat way of, it's not brainwashing, but there's a kind of ritualistic training you go through where you're taught that there's defense in depth, there's all these links in the safety chain, and don't worry about this system not working right because we have four other systems there as a backup. So you're basically taught to be complacent, tolerant of problems, and don't ask questions that somebody else has probably already got it covered. it's got to be right. Somebody else has already looked at it. Just go with the flow. So I think it's the questioning attitude that differentiates me from those tens of thousands of people who have the training and the background.
Well, you're more like a doctor, because we are trained in the opposite way, that we have to look out for problems all the time, be intensely curious, otherwise we'll probably lose our patient. And I want now to end this discussion, which is absolutely fascinating, by talking about the presidential candidates. We've got about 4 minutes left, David. I know that Barack Obama has received $240,000 from the nuclear industry, Exelon, and that David Axelbaum, who runs his campaign, worked as a consultant for Exelon. I know that Clinton has received huge amounts of money too from, I can't remember which part of the industry, but from the nuclear industry, and that McCain supports the industry. What we've been talking about is actually, you know, nuclear weapons within the communities of America, not that they would explode, but that they could kill tens of thousands or even more people if there was a problem. What would you say about these presidential candidates, and how can we get to them?
Well, I think it's, I agree there's a problem with presidential candidates, but it's actually larger than that. The Public Citizen, one of the groups who we work with quite a lot, did a survey of not too long ago that looked at the political action contributions that are made, and the nuclear companies outspent the tobacco industry in this country in giving money to candidates that are favorable towards nuclear power.
Really?
And that's just manifested itself in, you know, all of the presidential candidates getting lots of money from the nuclear industry.
Well, I know that there's that what they call a nuclear renaissance, but because the industry says that they're the answer to global warming and they have no emissions, which is an absolute outright lie, and don't have time to go into that now. But I would appeal to everyone listening to this program, and I'm sure that you would too, David, that you do live in a democracy and that you therefore must take responsibility and remove the funding from the nuclear industry for every single congressional, Senate and presidential candidate. Would you agree with that, David? And where do people go to get more information?
Well, I said a couple of things. I would agree with that. And I would also ask, one of the things we've been doing is ask people to contact their local congressman and their president and their presidential candidates and say, we want an effective nuclear regulatory commission to protect us from the inherent hazards of nuclear power. That's got to be a prerequisite for any nuclear renaissance in this country. They can contact their local governments from the web. They can find out who their congressmen are and drop them an email or call the office. They can check out our website. We have one of the things we added in the last year was a map of the United States that shows every reactor that's operating or planned or has been permanently shut down with as much information as we have on that reactor. That's available at www.ucsusa.org. It's called the Nuclear Power Information Tracker, and you can do a screening about how many reactors have the spent fuel pool up in the attic that we talked about earlier. You can do a screening on how many reactors are inherently safe, such that you don't have to worry about it. That turns out to be zero, but you can do various screenings on safety criteria that we think are afflicting these reactors and putting millions of Americans at undue risk.
Well, that's wonderful, and I would end by saying that as a physician, that not only should you watch the nuclear renaissance occur, you must stop it. And not only that, you must close down every single reactor in the United States. What you do with this ghastly, irradiated, terribly dangerous fuel that will last for hundreds of thousands of years, I do not know. But we've got a huge problem on our hands, and it's the greatest public health problem, I think, that faces the planet at this stage, apart from global warming or nuclear war. So, David, look, I want to thank you enormously from the bottom of my heart. You've been one of my mentors for so long, and that you play an incredibly important role in the United States, and you're one of the unsung heroes, I believe, in the United States at this time. So thank you so much, David.
Well, I appreciate it, Helen. I have tremendous respect for you, and I've always enjoyed working with you over the years.
My guest is David Lockbaum, Director of the Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists, which monitors licensed commercial nuclear power plants in the United States to identify and publicize safety risks.
What you're about to hear is an excerpt from the 1983 Oscar-winning documentary, If You Love This Planet. This production of the National Film Board of Canada features Australian pediatrician Helen Caldicott delivering a lecture on the potential medical and societal consequences of a nuclear war. The film includes newsreel records of the beginnings of the arms race and the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This film was labeled foreign political propaganda by the United States Justice Department in an attempt to limit its distribution. All distributors who sold a copy were required to give the purchaser's name to the Justice Department. This may have had the opposite effect from the suppression desired by the Reagan administration, as the negative label caused a rallying of support around the film from anti-censorship activists. During her Oscar acceptance speech, director Terry Nash thanked the U.S. Justice Department for their effective advertisement of her film.
So let's start at the beginning of the nuclear age. That was founded by Einstein, of course, when he discovered E equals mc squared. Energy equals the mass of the atom by the speed of light squared. An incredibly profound revelation.
Hell of an explosion and... Well, I guess that's all, sir.
Last enough.
Holy smoke. What's the matter with you, Weldon?
Well, it just occurred to me, sir. There, but by the grace of God, went I.
And Einstein said, "The splitting of the atom has changed everything save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe."
During a series of meetings in Potsdam, Germany, the final doom of Japan is settled by the Big Three and their advisors, delivering an ultimatum of unconditional surrender to the Nipponese warlords. The Japanese suffers the consequences. Swarms of B-29s and carrier task forces carry destruction to the Japanese homeland. These and the following scenes of the opening of the final assault on Japan were photographed by newsreel, Navy, and Signal Corps cameramen. The natural power of the universe is harnessed in the new atomic bomb. Its tremendous possibilities are explained in this chart. The mightiest, most destructive bombs yet produced, such as England's terrifying Grand Slam, weighing 11 tons, are puny midgets compared with the new atomic wonder. One of the first to smash the atom was Dr. Ernest Lawrence of California, inventor of the cyclotron, the atom-smashing machine. With global war, the government stepped into the picture. General Groves, head of the project, teamed up with Vannevar Bush, government director of science and research, and with Dr. Richard Tolman, technological expert. Seeking for the best base material to carry the explosive atoms, hundreds of prospectors ranged the province of Alberta. Scientists made uncounted tests before deciding on uranium, which contained atoms easiest of all to crack. The results justified the tremendous efforts. The president reports on the startling developments that sealed Japan's fate.
"We are now prepared to destroy more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have in any city. We shall destroy their docks, their factories, and their communications. Let there be no mistake, we shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware.
The army had been told to spare two cities in Japan so that they could scientifically test the results of these bombs on human beings and cities. How's that for thinking? And what happened was, at 8:15 a.m., a single plane appeared overhead in Hiroshima, and a single parachute appeared from the plane, and the Japanese were pleased. They thought the plane had been shot down, and the pilot was escaping. Another parachute opened adjacent to the first, and a little boy was reaching up to catch a red dragonfly on his hand against the blue sky. And there was a blinding flash, and he disappeared. And so did tens of thousands of other human beings. About 100,000 people were killed with that bomb. The second bomb was exploded 3 days later, and some people who escaped Hiroshima migrated to the only Christian center in Japan, thinking that would never be bombed. And they arrived just 3 days later to Nagasaki to receive the second bomb. And a lot of the Japanese, when you go there, will say to you, well, we sort of understand the first bomb, but they say, why the second? The bomb dropped on Hiroshima was equivalent to about 13,000 tons of TNT. That's a small bomb, but let me describe how big that was. The maximum payloads the big planes carried during the Second World War was 4 tons of bombs. That's the most they could carry, 4 tons. So they exploded a bomb that was 13,000 tons in millionths of a second. The hydrogen bomb, some of them are 20 megatons. That's equivalent to 20 million tons of TNT in one bomb. That's 4 times the size of all the bombs dropped during the Second World War. One bomb. Now, they once made a 50 megaton bomb, which America blew up in the Pacific, in the South Pacific, and they got such a terrible shock, they never did that again. They could easily make a 100 megaton bomb. They're awfully easy to make. If you exploded that in space, increasing the diameter of destruction the higher up you go, you could wipe out 6 western states of the United States of America with one bomb. You are all children of the atomic age. You have grown up with this. You probably have nightmares sometimes about nuclear war. Some of you, when you were young, practiced drill in your schools, hiding under your desks in case a bomb dropped, putting bits of paper on your head to hide from the nuclear explosions, right? You remember those days? So today, America has 30 to 35,000 nuclear weapons. That's enough, they say, the Pentagon says, to overkill, which is a Pentagon word and not a medical term, overkill every Russian human being 40 times. Russia has 20,000 bombs. That's enough to overkill every American human being 20 times. So who's ahead or who's behind? If you think about this in medical terminology, how many times can you kill a human being? And they say, oh, Russia's ahead. You see? The mentality is about at a level of a 9-year-old boy.
I guess there are a couple of things I don't know about this airplane, sir.
I'm glad to hear you admit it. That's the beginning of wisdom.
Well, sir, how soon do I get a chance to knock one up and down?
Soon enough.
The superpowers are like little boys playing in a sandbox, arguing about who has the biggest biceps or bow and arrow or truck or whatever. So, okay, America has all these bombs and so does Russia. Now, what would a nuclear war mean medically, and what's the probability of such a situation occurring? Of course, it's not going to be a war, you realize that. A war means that you fight a war and you win and you rebuild yourself up from the rubble. This is not a war. This is extermination. It's what you do to cockroaches, you exterminate them. So the probability of such a war occurring is quite high. The Joint Chiefs of Staff predicted in 1975 before a Senate committee that there was a 50-50 chance of a nuclear war occurring by 1985. That estimate was verified by a Harvard-MIT study, 1985. You've been reading the papers recently. I'm sure that President Reagan's advisors are telling us that we have to prepare ourselves psychologically for a nuclear war. I'm not very sure how you do that. The other thing they're saying to us, that it is possible to fight and win a nuclear war. Have you not read that lately or seen that on the television, to fight and win a nuclear war? Also a lunatic-type statement. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which was founded during Einstein's time, has a clock, a doomsday clock on the cover, which has moved only 10 times since 1945. During the years of detente, Kissinger and Nixon era, it was at 9 minutes to midnight. After Afghanistan, it was moved to 7. In January 1981, it was moved to 4 minutes to midnight, and the editors think they probably didn't move it far enough. George Kistiakowsky, who was Eisenhower's science advisor, who made the implosion mechanism for the first A-bomb, is an old man. He's 80. And he seriously doubts that we'll make it to the year 1990. And he's not alone. There are many famous, brilliant scientists and strategists who feel the same way. The Pentagon computers in this country have failed 151 times in the last year and a half. They keep seeing bombs coming from Russia. The most serious one was in November 1979 when someone plugged a war games tape into the fail-safe computer, the Pentagon. The computer made a mistake, and it detected weapons coming from Russia, so it put the whole world on nuclear alert for 6 minutes. Three squadrons of planes took off towards Russia, armed with nuclear weapons. At the 7th, the president was to be officially notified, but they couldn't find him. And if it hadn't been stopped at that point, 14 minutes later, we would have been annihilated. Now, let me describe how a nuclear war could occur and what would be the medical consequences of such a situation. Now, once a button's pressed, the weapons and their missiles go out into space. The space race has been mainly about weapons. They re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at 20 times the speed of sound and then land accurately on target. Meanwhile, the satellite and the radar from the other side detects the attack and the button's pressed. So the weapons pass virtually in space and the whole thing's over within about half an hour. Half an hour.
This is an excerpt from the 1983 Oscar-winning documentary, If You Love This Planet.
That's the show for today. Thanks for listening to If You Love This Planet. Next week, my guest will be Paul Gunter, director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear, an organization committed to eliminating nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Paul is also a watchdog of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I'm Helen Caldicott, and I look forward to your company next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is recorded at 2XX FM Community Radio in Canberra, Australia, and broadcast on the Pacifica Radio Network. If You Love This Planet is produced by Scott Powell, Amanda Bellerby, and Jasmine Williams. For more information on this program, to listen to previous shows, or to make a tax-free donation, visit our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org.